history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories to be told. There are some men and women who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom, but we'll never know unless we take the time to ask and listen to these stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired through these stories. And we're going to meet a gentleman today in Ogden, Utah, who's got quite a story. In fact, he's part of the story of the building we're sitting in, the George E. Wallen Veterans Home, a beautiful, brand-new-looking facility here. It's covered in snow at the moment, but a much different climate compared to where Bob Ramos grew up many, many moons ago in Georgetown, Texas. I bet you had some hot summers down there in Georgetown, Texas.
Incredibly hot. When summer came around, of course, at the time growing up in a small town, we just got used to that.
And I bet you got used to hard work, too. I mean, here you are growing up, one of five children. There are four of you brothers. You all served in the military, two in World War II, two in Korea. You served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, as we're going to hear. I bet you guys were awfully protective of your sister.
It's kind of a custom, yes. We took care of her, make sure that keep the boys away from our sister. So she was a overly protected young child.
What do you remember about your childhood? What did you spend your time on?
I'll have to go back and tell you why I didn't have a formal education. There was five of us. My father worked on the railroad. He got sick at early age with stomach cancer, so he died age 37.
Wow. How old were you at that time?
10. Mm-hmm. So I was the oldest of five children.
You were the man of the house at 10.
Right. Wow. Automatically, that's a Mexican custom that the oldest will have to try to help provide for the rest of the family. So right after my father died, he left mom a $300 insurance policy. So with that $300 at that time, 1935 in Georgetown, she bought a small house. It reminded me of a mobile home now, but this wasn't a mobile home. In fact, blacks and Mexicans lived in this region because of segregation.
And for folks who don't know, Georgetown is real close to Austin. They might not associate that part of Texas with segregation, but that's what you knew.
Oh, yeah. Something that we grew up with. So when my father was working, I attended school. But when my father died, I was like in the third grade. And after he passed away, my mother found out she couldn't provide for the rest of the kids. And she looked at me and said, "You're going to have to go to work."
At 10 years old?
At 10 years old.
What kind of work did you find?
Delivering newspapers, mowing lawns. Luckily, there was a small neighborhood store in Georgetown owned by a gentleman by the name of John Edgar Glenn. And I says, "Could you hire me if I came in, sweep the store, and kept the shelves stocked?" He says, "Okay. Man, you can start by taking the raw potatoes out and sweeping the store, keeping it clean." Yeah, okay. 10 cents an hour. Usually 8 hours, that's 80 cents, but he gave me a dollar. to a 10-year-old all the money in the world. So anyway, this thing started out beautifully. Like I said, I had very little school. I read pretty good, delivered newspapers. Afterwards, I would read. The only way to learn the sentence, if there were words I didn't understand, I talked to a friend of mine, and it's easy. Get your dictionary. That red book over there must be 50 years old. That has been a very close item in my life.
And I hear you getting emotional about that.
Yep.
That dictionary is your lifeline. That's how you educated yourself.
Right. But at that time, I found it easy. I didn't have to go to a structured school to learn. But I had to find a way to educate myself. So a dictionary was a big help. Anyway, after working a few weeks in the store, Mr. Glenn told me, tell your mother to come to the store once a week and take whatever she needs to feed the family at home.
Wow.
Free of charge. You just keep on working. You're doing a good job. Well, that was a big wow kind of thing, to feed the whole family.
Yeah, when you're feeding mom and five growing kids.
Six people.
Yeah.
In the meantime, then he taught me to check out a customer. No computers.
Yeah.
All manual. If the customer got potato, sugar, coffee, milk, bread, eggs, put each item, pencil, no piece of paper, add it up. Here is the map, and I found out that you can't live without map in your life.
That's a good point.
You use it sometimes without even thinking, okay, it's going to take 15 minutes from there to here. Math. Be here at a certain time. Math. A certain time for this interview. Math. 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 But I found out that I liked it. So at the time, everything was manual. Pencil and paper. Add up, divide, multiply, so forth. It worked out. So a few dollars a day, a few dollars a week, and then the war started in 1941.
So you were 16 at the time. Were you still working at Mr. Glenn's store there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Delivering Western Union telegrams, anything to make a nickel, a dime, a quarter, and that added it up.
Yeah.
Take home to mom.
And I want to ask you about December 7th, but just as you describe your experience, and no, you didn't have the formal education in the schoolhouse, but you're getting language from the newspapers you're delivering and the dictionary to cross-check things. You're getting math by working at the grocery store, all kinds of life lessons you're learning too. And even though you lost your father when you were 10, it sure sounds like the owner of this grocery store, Mr. Glenn, in many ways became a second father to you.
Exactly. And I think he pictured this. Mom would tell me, be kind to people. Help every chance you get. Help others. If you see, and especially women, the elderly, always keep that in mind. If you see somebody needing help, just walk up to him. Let me help you. So it became kind of a flag bearer sort of thing.
Became your identity, the guy who would help people.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever stopped to think how different your life would have been if Mr. Glenn had said, nah, kid, I don't need your help?
Yeah, I don't know where in life I would have landed, but I was determined to help mom and the family. Okay, she bought the house, but we had to pay for electricity. We had, Paul, a 15-amp bulb in the front room hanging from the ceiling. And there was only three rooms, living room, kitchen, dining combination, small room, and a bedroom.
And there were six of you. What were your sleeping arrangements?
So Mom, Lucy on the floor in the living room, and there's four boys in the back bedroom. The two youngest on bed, the two eldest on the floor. Johnny and I slept on the floor.
Until you went into the Army. Some guys, the Army was tough life. For you, it was an upgrade in some of these living conditions.
A lifesaver.
A lifesaver.
For me.
Well, tell me about, I don't want to forget to get this story, because everybody seems to have a story of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out what happened?
I was delivering papers. But gradually, for 3-4 months, the newspapers were carrying stories of it's coming because of the things the Japanese were doing on the Germans in Europe. Mm-hmm. They were gobbling up Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria, and so forth. So I would read this in the paper. Usually there was a small sketch of a map of that region, you know, read, that things are not good.
So the irony here is, because you were delivering these papers every day and reading these papers every day, you were probably a whole lot more in tune with world events than all those kids in the schoolhouse.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't a big surprise to you that the Japanese attacked?
No, because like I said, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure this thing out.
You were growing up in a hurry, I'm sure, because you had to.
Paul had joined a crew that came from Georgetown to Utah, thinning beets.
Harvesting the sugar beets?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Hard work, miserable. But the pay compared to the store was 3, 4, 5 times more money-wise. That usually took 6 weeks, 2 months. You go back to Texas. Week later, back to Utah.
How old were you when you were doing that?
15, probably 16. Because after the war was declared and the Selective Service Act was passed, which started this draft, I was in Montana, thinning beets. So I registered in Montana. I got drafted, so I hurried home, told Mom, because Mom also was thinking they're going to take my number one helper kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she started saying, I don't think that you're going to pass the exam. I said, Mom, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm going to pass the exam. And I want to go. What? Don't you know what you're saying? This is war and they're killing people. I said, Mom, I know that. But I have all my friends that are doing this. Mm. I wouldn't do it. Says, well, they're going to find something wrong with you and you will fail the exam. So that day came, I went to San Antonio, I passed the exam, and I knew that Mom was going to help out her time with this. So I came home. I said, guess what? You failed it. I said, no, I passed it. And she started crying.
She started crying.
So anyway, Paul, I reported San Antonio. I got issued all the stuff. And they put us on a bus. And I said, where are we going? I said, well, we can't talk about it. It's all secret. You got to learn this. Yep, you can't talk about this. You can't talk about that. We found ourselves Rockford, Illinois, Army basic to become a field combat medic.
And you're 18 years old?
I'm 18, Paul, and no education. And I'm going to learn the pressure points, the wounds, how to fix a wound in the stomach, in the head, or leg, limb. I don't have that education. But again, I looked around and there's other kids that are also wondering if we can do this. Mm-hmm. So I don't find myself isolated. There's others will have the same problem. We graduated. We learned all of those terms. 18 weeks of basic cram, 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 cram. Day, night, weekend, holidays. But we done it. I done it. So they kept me at Camp Grant for one training cycle. This is going to sound like bragging, but I was such a good soldier that they kept me as a helper to my staff sergeant or trainer. But I'll knew sooner later they're going to put you in the list. So, sure enough, all of a sudden, because of the war in Europe, they needed more frontline troops. Okay, the combat medic is a frontline assignment, but they needed more shooters.
When you're in training there at Camp Grant, did they know you'd never gone to high school?
Oh, yeah.
They knew. They
oh,
knew.
Yeah.
But
oh,
you did
yeah.
such a good job, they said, we want to keep this guy around to help train other people.
Because he tries. He tries and excels. He's a quick learner.
So that saved you from going overseas earlier.
Uh-huh.
But then, because of something that they did to mark your birthday, I mean, wasn't it your 19th birthday that this big invasion happens, June 6, 1944?
Yeah.
And because of everything that followed, now they needed more people over there.
Right.
Especially once the bulge hit.
Right.
Then they really needed people. So they right. say, sorry, you're not going to be a medic anymore.
Right.
All right.
We're going to teach you how to shoot a rifle, pistol, hand grenade. Everything that an infantryman is supposed to know. So they sent me to Camp Maxey, Texas, Paris, Texas, for 4 weeks. And then from there, they sent me to Fort Lewis, Washington. Then from there, overseas.
And we'll follow Bob overseas when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 91-year-old Bob Ramos of Ogden, Utah, originally from Georgetown, Texas. We're about to hear about his experiences with the 86th Infantry Division during World War II, but first, let's clear this up. I introduced you as Bob, but your given name is Norberto. That's what your mother called you. How did the Army turn Norberto into Bob? Can you tell us that story?
There's more Anglo-Saxons in the barracks than Mexicans. So we became buddies. I could speak good English. My English was not broken. I could hold a conversation, so I could hold my own. I was so proud of this because no schooling.
Yeah. And so when you said Norberto, they couldn't say that?
Yeah, they kept asking, how do you spell that? How do you spell that? And I would tell them. And then they'd walk away. What's the translation for that? James or Pete or... They couldn't come up with anything. So one guy kept saying, I think his name is Roberto. I don't think he knows how to spell.
They thought they knew better than you, huh?
Yeah. So I could hear him. The poor guy doesn't know his real name. He's Mexican. And he probably hasn't been in the country too long.
Even though you're born here.
Even though I was born and raised. So this thing started. Roberto instead of Roberto. Okay, Roberto translated Robert.
Yeah.
Nickname for Robert, Bob.
Uh-huh.
So lots of Italians, do you mind if we start calling you Bob? Whatever. That's easy. Spelled the same way forward and reverse. Okay. Okay, Bob.
And you've been Bob ever since?
Yeah.
So you go over as a replacement troop. You don't know where you're going to be sent. But the Battle of the Bulge has just wrapped up. They're still recovering from that. They've suffered a lot of casualties, so they need guys a lot of places, and they stick you with this 86th Infantry Division, the Black Hawk Division. And a lot of people don't know that the hockey team, the Chicago Blackhawks, got its name from your infantry division.
Right.
Because a guy from your division ended up owning that team, right?
Right.
How about that? So your legacy lives on every time they play hockey in Chicago.
We get into a personnel carrier kind of vehicle. The guy says, okay, from here on out, no talking, no smoking. We're going to go into close to enemy front lines. Man, every word was heard and kind of kept in a pocket. This guy takes us to a tech sergeant, Roy Gregory, from Tennessee, in the tent. Little bitty flashlight for illumination. Finally, he gets to me. What's your name? And I tell him. And again, the same thing. How do you spell that? Where are you from? But I told it, I like to go by Bob. Good. From now on, it's Bob. On the helmet and whatever. So I get assigned to a squad. And the squad leader, Staff Sergeant Atkins, and get into a front line rifle platoon. This is nighttime, about 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm tired. I want to go get some sleep. Staff Sergeant Atkins says, Bob, let me talk to you. This is real. The Germans are across this river. We know they're sending patrols over here to see what we're doing. And we sent patrols over there. This is not a movie, son. I can remember those words.
Wow.
Son, this is not a movie. Considering yourself on the front line. So far, everything is quiet. But in about 2 hours from now, when it gets light, we don't know what the hell's going to happen. You say you want some nap time? We don't have cots here for that. Sit down. And it was raining. Sit down like the rest of the guys here. Cover yourself with your poncho. You're going to get wet, but this is it. So good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. And sure enough, as soon as he got daylight, where you could tell with the little fog, all hell broke loose. So that was my day of baptism.
What does that mean? What kinds of things were you seeing and hearing and experiencing that you'd never experienced before?
I didn't get much sleep because I'm scared to death. Because every now and then we heard rifle fire. And then Sergeant Atkins assigned me to a kid, Nichols, in a foxhole. Right in, so there was so much water in the foxhole. Our boots are feet are wet and so forth. But a poncho over the foxhole is not keeping the water out because the water is filtering into the hole. So I'm learning this is pure caca, you know.
Yeah, misery.
You can use your mess gear to take the water out, but you have to keep your eye out because you're in a combat zone. When we crossed the river, and then we started fanning out, attacking a pocket here, I was a recruit. I'm attached to this young kid who has been in a few skirmishes before, so he's a little knowledgeable and well-to-do, so I'm holding my own to him like dear mother. Attack here and attack here. Find yourself a hole or something to protect yourself from incoming, and then orders come all of a sudden, get on a tank. This unit, get on these tanks that are coming up. Get on top of them because they're going to take off and chase a unit and so forth. This, to me, was just before the Ruhr pocket. The only thing that you can remember is the training that they gave you to protect yourself in this manner or that manner. And of course, most of it, when they said get on this tank, says, why? Why should I get on this? Get on the tank and tie yourself to it because it's going to take off. And maybe 2 miles or 3 miles, they'll stop, take cover, try to find a building, a hole, anything to protect yourself. And Sergeant Atkins was a good leader. He took care of his troops. Is 15 in the squad.
What was the scariest thing to deal with?
The Germans had good weapons. They had a rifle that we called a burp gun, which was good and accurate. Their tanks were super tanks. Hand grenades, same thing. The mashed potato thing. And good fighting troops. I mean, they were good. When you know this and you get into your skirmish, you better be the best, more than him. Most of the time, we found ourselves 10, 20, 30 yards apart in the skirmish.
10, 20, 30 yards from the Germans?
Yeah.
Firing at each other at close range?
Right.
Tossing hand grenades?
We found out that some of these guys could really throw 10 yards and some 20 yards. We could do the same thing with a hand grenade if you could throw a baseball from home base to first, you're okay. But further than that, you don't know because I threw one, but I found out real quick I couldn't throw it like a baseball. So I had to run and threw it this way, over me.
Yeah, you got to scoop it.
Because the thing doesn't weigh. It's not that heavy.
Not heavy enough to fly that way.
Now, their potato masher thing, because of that handle, you can really throw that thing.
The German hand grenades with the long, slender handle and the protrusion at the top.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about being that close to the enemy.
At night, that's when it gets heavy, because you can tell where they're at if they fire their rifle or their pistol. And, of course, they can do the same thing to you. And Atkins and Williams told us, okay, if we face like that at night, you fire and then you roll over to the left or you roll over to the right.
Fires, and then when they see your muzzle blast, move so they don't fire and hit you.
Right. All part of survival.
Yeah.
Kind of thing that you learn sometimes at the front.
Tell me about some of your closest calls, the times where you look back now and say, man, how did I survive that?
Thank me and the guy, Fred, I forget his last name, from Chicago. We knew that the Germans were not too far from us. Nightfall, just as dark as could be, and they were waiting for us to do something, and we were waiting for them to do something. So we're laying down with our M1, and I hear a tank. And this thing is coming toward us. But everything's quiet. Paul, the thing kept coming, and we didn't fire anything because this thing wasn't firing. The thing passed about 10 yards away from me and Fred. It just passed.
So you guys are in a foxhole?
No, we're not in a foxhole.
You're above ground.
We're just above ground.
But it's dark out.
It's like 2 o'clock in the morning.
You can't even really see it at first. You just hear it.
Yeah. When I heard it first, I whispered to Fred, you hear anything? He says, I hear it, but I don't know where it's going. And it was coming slow, like he's searching. So then all of a sudden I looked to the right, and it's dark as it was, and the tank was black, it passed. It passed us.
You could just barely make it out, probably, huh?
And then the noise got, but he was like idling, like he's searching for some object to be thrown at him.
So if you had fired, you probably would have been killed.
We didn't have anything to kill that thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
you would have just bounced off of him.
Oh, yeah. It could have done some damage to the track, but all we had was a hand grenade. I told Fred later, if I'd have thrown this thing and disabled it, that tank would have been right there. So the guy could have just used his turret.
Yeah, he could have swiveled around and fired away.
Sure.
So those had to be some pretty tense moments there waiting for it to pass.
Well, for recruit me, Fred had some experience with me. He said,
told you to lay low.
And we didn't have no radio to pass the information down. And then we found out that this guy, much later, was looking to give himself up and his crew.
Oh, really? That's why he was going so slow.
But I'm not going to say, hey, guy, you got surrendered to me, because I don't know what was his intentions.
Yeah.
So that was my big, big thing, because Fred now just scared to death, and we don't have the equipment to disable this. We're just going to let him go on through.
You mentioned the Ruhr Pocket, and there was some awfully fierce fighting around there toward the end of the war in Europe. What kinds of things did you see, and did you ever have to deal with the reality of losing some guys that you had gotten to know?
Yeah, three of them. Lou Skinner for one. The Ruhr Pocket was just a huge, huge war. The big tanks, all kinds of tanks. The 86 plus of the divisions circled this valley, including Patton's units. They put up a good fight, but at that time, most of them were just saying, if they're Americans, let's give it up. If we're fighting Russians, we might not get a good treatment.
Yeah.
But if they're Americans, hell yeah. I saw two kids in a small village going through. We were marching on this road. And for some reason, I got out of line of marching because I had some candy in my pocket. And I broke ranks and I walked with these two kids. Little kids by the fire that we were trying to keep warm, got my hands in my pocket to give them some candy, and I heard Sergeant Gregory scream, Ramos, get back in line. I heard him, and I heard him afterwards. He chewed my fanny out for breaking ranks. I shouldn't have, but I've done it without even thinking, just to help two kids with candy that I just wanted to give to the kids.
Were you able to give it to them, or you didn't have time?
No, I gave it to them.
You gave it to them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was giving it to them when he screamed.
And you got in trouble for it?
Oh, yeah.
Was it worth it?
Yeah, it was worth it. They told me thank you and so forth. Just incidents like that, when one of us would get shot and so forth. Right away, who was it? Who got shot? Is it just a wound, or is he dead? That was Skinner.
Yeah, you mentioned Skinner. What happened to him?
He got killed afterwards. We heard that he's buried at Arlington.
Was that hard to deal with? Someone that you knew not being there anymore?
Yeah. You know, we expect it, but when it happens, it hurts. It hurts.
Did you ever think, what if I'm next?
Oh, yeah, all of that time. All of that time, because war. I mean, you're there to shoot each other to see who's going to get it first. Either you're going to get it first or he's going to get it first. Always in our mind.
Understandably so. It is break time again. Remember, you can check out photos and videos of Bob at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll hear how he was instrumental in the construction of the veterans' home that he now lives in when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode recorded at the beautiful George E. Wallen Veterans Home in Ogden, Utah, with a guy who helped get it built. We've heard how Bob Ramos left school at age 10 to work and support the family after his father died, and also how he ended up on the front lines in Europe with the 86th Infantry Division.
How about when Germany surrendered? Was that a big deal?
Oh, Paul, what a feeling. What a feeling. It happened to us. We were in Austria, May 8th, 1945. The Germans have surrendered. Just word of mouth. Pass it on. Just keep calm. There'll be more information. Then after an hour or so, the sergeants get together, and then they come around, patch in the back, and say, okay, get up. The Germans have surrendered. And then we were told at exactly midnight, Eisenhower has given the order for every American Allied artillery gun would fire one salvo at exactly midnight. So we looked for that. And when it happened, it was like this daylight, just for a second. But we didn't whoop the dial or anything. We just kind of sat where we could have a good seat and started thinking, I made it.
But you weren't done yet.
Not the 86th. We came back to the harbor, board ship, back to the 86th pier, the same pier that we're not going over, to come all the way across the United States to Oklahoma. Camp Gruber, where the 86th was going to go, processed. They gave us 2 weeks leave back to Gruber.
When you had that two-week leave, did you get to go home and see your mom?
Yep.
What was that like?
They think that you're going to get killed, hurt, whatever. Moms.
Yeah.
Here I come home and so forth. And I didn't tell them beforehand.
That you were coming. She didn't know.
Here I am, my uniform and so forth, of course. She just cried and cried. Mm. My sister, my other brothers were gone. So it was just the biggest day in our family. Mm. I was home. But big question mark. Japan.
Yeah. So here you show up out of the blue.
I mean, 2 weeks. Yeah. With my friends, my family, and then mom, I'm going to have to go back this time to Japan. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Here she thinks all her prayers have been answered. Her son has come home.
Right.
And then you're heading back off to war.
Yeah. Cam Stoneman, board ship. In the Pacific. And again, there were flotilla ships and so forth going to Japan. We were on the ship when they dropped the two.
Uh-huh.
So then we thought, everybody, 86 says, okay, guys, oh, man, we're going to go home. We're going to go home. This is a good day.
Yeah.
We're all here. We're going to go home. No. All of a sudden, the PA assistant came on and says, 86 is going on to the Philippines to relieve the 37th Infantry who had been on the line for months. We found ourselves in the Philippines. We for 6 months because the Japanese did not believe that Japan had surrendered.
There were still pockets of soldiers.
Thousands of them. Thousands. We built POW camps just crammed full, and some of those guys were committing suicide. They had brought hand grenades in camp. Our civil engineers built those camps, and we guarded them for a spell and then turned it over to the Filipino army. But then at first we had to secure the waterworks, radio stations, things like that. The 86 first secured that.
Uh-huh.
Then we turned it over to the Filipino. But there were thousands and thousands of Japanese troops in the mountains. That took months and months to get down to give themselves up.
Was there anything memorable about the time that you spent guarding those camps and seeing all these Japanese prisoners?
Looking at them just like opposite of us, but knowing that they started it, not us. And now the atrocities that they had performed and so forth, it was hatred, 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 I felt. And so my friends' hatred as to what they had done then got us into this world war. But then after a spell, they're just like us.
Yeah.
They're ordered to do whatever, you know.
So initially, much like you had probably felt about the Germans when you found out what had happened in the Holocaust, you know about the Bataan Death March, you know about the execution and torture of so many prisoners, so you are despising these people you're guarding, but the more time you spent around them, the more human you realized they were?
Yeah, because we didn't buddy belt in and so forth kind of thing.
Yeah.
They were prisoners. We were on the outside. But then we kind of filtered away and got some prisoners that we could trust to help us clean up the camps where we were. So we became like friends.
So you were drafted into World War II, served in both Europe and the Pacific in the infantry. Not too many guys can say that. But then you got drafted again during the Korean War?
Went home, went back to school. I thought, you know, school can help me and it's free. Might as well take advantage.
Uh-huh.
GI Bill. Became a civilian, got me a car, my first car ever. I felt more like a man instead of an 18-year-old kid that left not knowing nothing, scared to death, but survived 2 continents. I felt so good. Texas had, at that time, every guy that got discharged had to join the reserves. So I joined the reserves. Didn't pay any attention to them because I thought, I've done my thing, I'm okay. Then all of a sudden, Korea came up. I got orders that the medical unit that I was with originally got recalled. So the Air Force had just come into being.
Yeah.
I left jets. If they're going to call me back again, might as well try to get into something that I like.
And he didn't just like the Air Force, he loved it. Bob put in 20 more years, including handling security surrounding the U-2 spy planes in Del Rio, Texas, where he also supervised an Air Force stockade for a while. After retiring, his desire to help people kept him volunteering. 27 years at the base pharmacy at Hill Air Force Base, he also worked with politicians and businessmen to fund programs for returning veterans from Vietnam. He organized the very first Veterans Job Fair in the USA, and when he met a kindred spirit named George Wallen, a vision for veterans' homes in the Beehive State started to come into focus.
I had my first claim for this veteran. I took it to the VA, and there was George there.
Uh-huh.
So we started talking and found out we had a lot in common. He was a combat medic. I was a combat medic for a short time.
Right.
We both got trained. He's 9 months older than me. When I put the claims in and so forth, we started becoming buddies and so forth. Then we started talking about veterans' homes in Utah. Just a dream.
Because there were none at the time.
Right. Not.
Not one.
One even mentioned. Idaho had 4. When we found that out, we thought, hey, how come they got 4 and we don't have any? And we got as many veterans more. So George and I started yakking.
He started making noise, trying to get people's attention.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. politicians in Utah, for some reason, Paul, they just didn't care. We don't have time. We got other priorities.
So what do you think finally made the difference? Is it just persistence?
A lot of persistence, yes. At one time, the state, when we asked for funds to start one, Sandy appropriated funds for a soccer stadium, millions of dollars.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't get a mention.
Uh-huh.
Nothing. So when they would get this bus, 40-passenger bus, and they would get a bunch of soccer balls, and we went into the Capitol, we knocked in some of the politicians' office and threw a soccer ball into their office. We got a bunch of soccer balls all uh-huh. over the Capitol. It kind of, whoops,
yeah.
you know.
That sounds crazy, but that gesture changed some minds.
Paul, you don't know. You got accidentally like this, and it gets your attention.
So Governor John Huntsman signed the bill that created the funding to build this facility. How much did it cost to build this?
A little over $13
million. $13 million.
13 and a half acres.
So it has a capacity of 120 veterans.
With the largest of the four. That's like I call it the flagship.
The largest veterans home in the state of Utah. So you were here to open it in 2009.
Break ground.
Uh-huh. How proud of a moment was that for you when it actually opened and the first veterans got to come live here?
I think it got too big for me.
It was overwhelming.
Overwhelming because the thought of me being a part of this didn't even come to my senses. If I go back before I started doing anything, I come from nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Dirt, practically.
You were sleeping on the floor until you got in the Army.
No schooling to speak of. Self-taught. Work hard because nothing is going to be given to you. And I know things get done if you work hard.
After everything you've been through, the childhood and the hardships that you dealt with, that you shared with us, infantry combat in World War II in Europe and then heading over to the Pacific, 20 years in the Air Force, everything since then, what would you say that you're most thankful for and what you're most proud of?
My humble way of thinking. First, I was lucky to have been born in this country, and I'm thankful for my mom, who raised us and taught us right from wrong. I was offered so much by my country for having served. I was offered so much schooling benefits that no other country has ever offered their veterans. And I don't know this to be true because I've done this kind of work for over 60 years now. I believe in a divine being always there. I pray every morning. I pray every night. I start with thanking my God for my health and my life. And then I say, God, let me help one person today. If I can help one, I'm okay. If I can help five, fine. But let me help at least one.
Someone said to me recently, do for one what you wish you could do for many. You've been doing that for a long time. And now you look back and you have done it for many. And everybody who lives in this veteran's home has you to thank for helping to make it possible.
Yeah, but see, I don't feel like that.
Isn't that the truth, though?
Yeah, but I am just one of many. But I don't think I've done it by myself. I've speak up on what you believe. And if you believe in it hard enough, it could come true. There's so many little things that fit into this giant puzzle, but it takes more than one.
Yep.
I think the only one that is a one is God.
Amen. Well, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for serving veterans for so long. I know you're not going to stop anytime soon.
No.
Is there anything else that you think people really need to know about this country you love so much?
I think our younger generation needs to slow down and at one time or another stop and think. I have a lot to be thankful for. I want to thank Almighty for this day. If tomorrow I'm here, thank him again, because he's the big reason of what I've done. He is my advisor.
Well, this beautiful veteran's home is evidence you've been getting good advice for a long time. That is Bob Ramos of Ogden, Utah. Check out the photos of Bob at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also see a short video with what President Barack Obama gave Bob when he visited the White House in 2012. We're out of time for now. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.